call is now being recorded. Please go ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, can Professor Mbedi hear?
Morning, good afternoon, good evening, everyone. This is the IRCTB call, 20th of July. And on the call, we have Michele Nilon, James Bladel, Kevin Erdmann, Barry Cobb, Matt Serlin, Paul Deer, Anil George, and Bob Martin. We have apologies from Rob Golding. And for staff, we have Marika Koenig, myself, Linda, and I see that Godwin Shombe has just joined us too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
And Glenn, we also have apologies from Barbara Steele.
Yeah,
and from Bob. Thank you very much, Marika. And you may go ahead, Nick.
Okay, thank you. If whoever it is, there's somebody on here who has a very loud phone. Could you please mute yourself? Whoever it is, it sounds like you're in a bar, which means that you're probably just making me jealous. But apart from that, you're also drowning out everybody else. Okay, the first item on the agenda today was in relation to the public comment forum, as we were discussing on the last call and then via email afterwards, whether we needed to extend the deadline by a couple of weeks. To that end, based on the on some of the emails that were sent to the list following on from the call, it became apparent that there was a certain degree of diversity of opinion with in that respect.
Okay, thank you.
So I posted a simple doodle to the list a few days ago. Unfortunately, we the doodle was how can I put this diplomatically? Quite a few people placed votes on the doodle who are not members of the working group, but the results of the doodle for the people who are members of the working group, or at least were members of the working group at the time that they took the vote, is now on the Adobe Connect. For those of you who aren't on the Adobe Connect, the number of votes in favor of extending the comment period was 5. The number of votes against extending the comment period was 7. So there were a total of 12 votes, 5 in favor, 7 against. However, we also, as well, if you look at the comments... Hello, sorry?
Yeah, I'm not live, yes.
If we look at the comment period archive, there are also a few people who submitted comments to the comment period to the effect that they wanted the comment period extended. So does anybody have any thoughts on this?
Michele, it's Paul.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul.
Look, I just wanted to say for the group, I had voted in favor, but in truth, I wish there had been a third column. I don't care one way or another. I think the push for extension was made by a particular former member of the group, and while I had some sympathy for a two-week extension, that person wanted it to go all the way to September, which was completely beyond reason. If it makes it any easier, if you want a more definitive, I'm willing to change my vote. But, you know, I'm just looking right now. Are there even any comments in there? Yeah, you know, I mean, there are 5 or 6 comments in total, 7, excuse me, 3 of whom came from the former member or somebody parroting what he had already said. I think people understand the deadline is Sunday and get your points made and let's keep moving on with this particular group.
Okay. Thank you. Bob, go ahead.
Yeah, I would support Paul's comment. I would not object to a very short extension. On the other hand, I think a lot's to be said with the deadline is what it is, and you're going to get most of your comments within whatever that deadline is, whether it's this Sunday or extended out 2 weeks. So I don't believe that an extension would really increase the amount of comments that we would end up with. So I could go either way, but and I was traveling and on vacation. Unfortunately, I couldn't vote. My vote would have been, with the absence of that third column, it would have been no.
Okay. Marika, what? I see your hand up. Marika and then James.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think I made the comment before as well that I'm not really sure indeed if extending the comment period will necessarily result in more comments, as I do think people just note the deadline and either submit comments or they don't. But at the same time, I think we already decided that we wouldn't have calls the first 2 weeks of August. So I'm wondering as well what will be the harm of just extending those, respecting as well that some people actually took the time to submit comments to the public forum asking for an extension. So hopefully that, you know, will give them an incentive as well to actually prepare more substantive comments on the report and, you know, just add the 2 weeks to it and leave it at that. That would be my personal opinion, but I respect whatever the group wants to do in that respect.
Okay, thank you. James and then Anil.
This is James. I have a procedural question, so go ahead and put me in the back of the queue.
Okay, this is Anil. I had a late vote. I had just voted that I would probably favor an extension for 2 weeks. I think given that there is at least some interest for an extension, I kind of agree with Marika and some others that I don't think a two-week extension is unreasonable, and it may be a fair thing to do, given that there's at least some interest in some quarters, to have a little bit more time.
Okay, thank you. James, go ahead.
Yeah, and that's fine as well. Just a procedural question. One of the comments received thus far includes a synopsis of some discussion forums that are related to various aftermarket industries. And I'm wondering, you know, just what the appropriate level is for securing permission from those individuals who actually wrote those posts, whether or not they wanted their comments or feedbacks included in the ICANN public forum. Does that make any sense? I mean, can we just list, discussions that are going on in other venues and then include them into the public forum when the folks participating in those forums may not be aware of that?
It's a very interesting point, James. I was looking, I have to admit that I have not read all of the ICANN bylaws inside out and back to front, but one of the things that I was reading over in the bylaws was in relation specifically to public comment periods. And the bylaws specifically state that the commenter has to be identified. I can find the exact wording if you want. But there was a thing about the person submitting the comment couldn't be anonymous was basically the key takeaway. There's another thing as well. I'm sorry, just finish. There's another thing as well, which is, as far as I'm aware, now I can't speak for all territories, but in most territories, if you post a comment or whatever on a forum, it remains your copyright. So for us to start lifting comments from various fora, I mean, obviously, if the former member of this working group were to point us at his own comments, that's fine, because he's obviously giving his permission. But we can't assume that we have permission to take comments from other people. That's just my take on it. I will bow to the people who have legal degrees who are on this call. Does anybody want to jump in? Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. Just to say it up front, I don't have a legal degree, so I'm not sure whether I'm qualified to speak on this subject. But, apart from what is submitted to the public comment forum, which, you know, the working group has a duty to review and take into account, I don't think anything would prevent working group members to put forward information or articles or whatever they've seen in other fora and include that as part of the deliberations as long as the rest of the working group agrees. Because I think what we've done as well on the basis of the discussion we had in Brussels, we already created a list of bullet points based on comments that were made in that forum, that I think the intention was to include that as part of all the comments that will be received as part of the public comment forum. So that will be an alternative means if, you know, those people don't agree or don't explicitly indicate that they would like those comments to see submitted, as another way for the group to actually, you know, take it into account when they start reviewing the different comments received.
Yeah, Marika, just one thing. Is just, I think one of the things I was going to mention was that at least one of the four I mentioned is private. It's not, you can't actually see the posts unless you are a member, which I think it's different than just pointing somebody out to, say, a blog article that would be public. Kevin, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I'll just first make the comment for myself and any other person with a legal degree and or admissions and all that. We are somewhat limited in our ability to pontificate on these issues by the jurisdictions in which we're licensed. But that having been said, I would say generally that if you took a very strict view of copyright law, that there was an absolute prohibition from ever taking any minuscule amount of a copyrighted material and using it in another manner, then that analysis would be correct. In the United States, there are a lot of exceptions that might allow some quoting of the those types of materials, and perhaps even the use of the whole materials. One would be that it was either a de minimis taking. Another would be that it's fair use because it's part of a commentary and critique and all that. Another might be that there's an implied license to use it, as under the ICANN rules, that's what you're supposed to do with it, so that if you post to that list, that you're submitting yourself to the ICANN rules, which says, well, we're going to, you know, have the ability to repost it. I would also say generally in most European jurisdictions where moral rights are quite validly and rigorously enforced, it's important to make sure that the integrity of the remarks are kept and that there's proper attribution so that those postings aren't taken out of context and wouldn't be misconstrued. So that there are some sticky issues that might be involved, particularly if there is a substantial work that was only partially directed to the object of the discussion and there were other potential commercial uses of the material. So I, you know, to summarize, yeah, there could be some problems with it. I think that generally it would be permitted under most laws that I'm aware of, but on the other hand, there's always, you know, particular cases that might get one into trouble, and hopefully those on the ICANN staff would interact with the ICANN legal to make sure that they feel comfortable posting that material.
Okay, thank you, Kevin. Chris, go ahead.
Yes, I mean, from a non-legal point of view, I think you know if you're posting something on a public forum, it may well get posted elsewhere. I mean, it's just common knowledge, isn't it, really? Copyright or no copyright law and different jurisdictions. We just had one in the BC where Philip Shepherd's posted something and George Kirkus has retweeted it, and I think it's gone round possibly more than he ever originally intended, but you know, he posted it, so there we are. Which actual post are we talking about? Which comment is it? I can't find it.
It's the one, I will, spare me one second. I was putting it on the Adobe Connect, Chris.
Thank you.
I've just pasted the link. The body of the mail is, I'd like to place in the comments archive the public discussions on the ETRP from both domainstate.com and dnforum.com. See PDF attachments. Well, one can view the original threads by the links in the PDFs too, sincerely, etc., etc. No, I think ultimately, guys, if you're comfortable with including it, then so be it. I mean, I personally don't have any view either one way or the other.
Yeah, I wouldn't like to just take it out on you know, possible grounds like that that we're not totally sure of anyway.
Okay, thank you. Somebody else have their hand up there? James, and then Anil?
Yeah, this is James, and just my final thoughts on this were that you raise a good point. There are three questions about doing something like this. One is the permission of the individuals was, I don't see, was explicitly obtained. Two was the anonymity of the of some of the comments that were received in there. We can't necessarily verify their identity. And three, the fact that some of these were submitted, as you said, to a non-public or a members-only type of form. And, you know, I'm fine with it being included either way. I don't necessarily have any objections, but it was just mainly more of a procedural question. You know, I hate to see some of my private conversations or Facebook threads show up in an ICANN record, so I just wanted to think for the future a little bit.
Yeah, this is Anil. I think given that the comment has already been posted, it's already, included publicly. So I don't know that it would make sense or be fair to necessarily exclude it. I mean, on the copyright issue, as Kevin said, you know, you can make arguments either way. I don't know that it is our it is our duty necessarily to evaluate the merits of the copyright issue here. I think we can, take that into account in assessing the value of the comment, but I don't know that we need to make any conclusion about it in terms of copyright issues.
Okay, thank you. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika. I actually didn't catch the email that, you know, had attachments. I thought it was more talking about, you know, other forums where this issue was discussed. And I'm happy to take the question back to ICANN Legal to see what they say. I mean, in any event, I think if you can see, you know, as well in the bylaw language, there is staff manager's discretion to, you know, whether include certain comments in the summary or not. So if it's deemed, for example, by legal counsel or if the working group says, look, this indeed, we cannot attribute these comments to an individual, and, you know, we have concerns that people that have posted comments there, you know, might not want to have their comments posted here, you know, we can deal with that in that way. But I'm definitely going to take it back to ICANN Legal Counsel, get their opinion. Just to note, I think that Dan Hallon is on holiday for 2 weeks or so, so it might take a little bit before I get an answer on that. So in that regard, an extension might possibly work in our advantage from that perspective too.
Okay. Let's ask a very, very simple question, okay? Very, very simple. Is there anybody who is vehemently opposed to us just letting it extend for the 2 weeks, as we were talking about? Because, I mean, bearing in mind the fact that there is definitely an interest from a certain number of people, plus there were people whose votes on the doodle we had to remove as they weren't members of the working group, plus the fact that we also had comments posted to the comment period archive asking explicitly for an extension. Is there anybody who is violently opposed? Kevin, go ahead.
I would just want to say I'm not violently opposed to it. I'm just sort of generally, unless there's a real good reason that goes beyond, you know, the scheduling inequities or whatever that to just stick with the track. I'm not violently opposed to a couple weeks, but I wouldn't want to see this, you know, then occur that then we need a couple more weeks, then we need a couple more weeks, and all of a sudden we're, you know, 3 months behind. So,
okay, well, just to assure you about one thing. I mean, we're talking about a one-time only 2-week extension. There's been no.
In that context, it doesn't matter that much to me.
Okay, Chris.
Yeah, I'm the same. I'm not violently opposed, and I do see at least three requests in the postings asking for more time, and also our 2-week holiday. I didn't know about that, but it doesn't make much sense, does it, to close it and then do nothing at all for 2 weeks. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Anybody else have any other comments on this? No? Okay. Well, look. Oh, Chris, go ahead.
No, just fill it in around to lower the hand.
Okay. Chris is kind of waving hands around the place. Okay, so we'll ignore that. Okay, based on that then, if we just let it roll for the 2 weeks and be done with it, and let's move on with our lives. Okay. Right. Moving on. We were looking at Charter Issue C, whether special provisions are needed for a change of registrant when it occurs near the time of a change of registrar. And we've had some discussion on the mailing list and some interesting contributions from people with respect to, well, I think one of the key things that we seem to be having is what exactly constitutes a change of registrant. Have all of you on the call been following the discussion on the mailing list?
Yeah.
Does anybody have any contributions or thoughts or anything on this? James.
Yeah, just a minor thought that I wanted to throw up to the group to consider is that when we use the term registrant, it may be somewhat ambiguous. I think that the RAA and other documents refer to registered name holder, RNH, as just what we needed this morning was a new acronym. But I think for the purposes of clarity, our charter question, the way it's worded, may be ambiguous unless we were to change it to change of registered name holder.
Sorry, James, sorry for being obtuse, but what's the difference?
The difference is I'm just trying to align our terminology. When we're looking for change of registrant in all these documents, we're reporting back that we can't find it.
Maybe we're
in the wrong place.
Okay, no, that's fine. That's fair enough. Marika?
Yeah, this is Marika, not on this specific question, but relating to the Charter Issue C in relation to some of the questions that were raised by George for compliance. I just wanted to know for the record that, you know, we are looking into this, but we'll require a little bit more time to come back to with an answer to the group as the compliance team needs to look into a number of issues. And as I said, we have some people that are on vacation currently, but as soon as we have a response, I'll get that back to the working group.
Plus, as well, compliance has no longer has their fearless leader. So I believe Pam Little is now is currently in charge.
That's correct.
Anil is asking what the new comment period end date would be. Marika, as you're the super-duper staff person on this call, could you confirm what that date would be?
On my calendar, that would be the 8th of August.
Okay. Anil, did you get that?
Yes, thank you.
I'll send a note shortly to our web admin team to change it on the website, and I'll also send a notice to the council, and Glenn will then get it out to all the constituencies, noting the extension, so we can make sure everyone's aware.
Right. Perfect. Thank you. Okay, so Chris is saying he's going to add James's new acronym. Thank you for the new acronym, James. We all appreciate it. Okay, then. So, whether special provisions are needed for a change of registrant, does anybody think have any strong feelings about this one way or the other? Nobody cares. James.
Wait, when you say strong feelings about this, you mean on the merits of the question?
Well, not just on the merits of the question, because, I mean...
I don't understand what you're asking us for. Sorry.
Oh, sorry, okay. Do you, James Bladel, have an emotive response to that question? Do you feel strongly that something should be done?
You know, I feel fairly strongly that registrars should be permitted some discretion in managing that situation where a change of registered name holder occurs in conjunction with a transfer. and it's you know, if there's other factors that would cause them to be suspicious and think that a security breach has occurred, that they shouldn't, by you know, by way of different agreements such as the RAA, they shouldn't be required to sit on their hands and allow that security breach to take place. Whether that translates into a best practice or recommendation for change in the policy, I haven't really arrived at any conclusions there, but I do feel that it is something that needs to be looked at, and we certainly don't want to write or codify loopholes into transfer policy.
Okay. Mass?
Thanks, Michele. I'd agree with James that I think something that allows registrars to act at their discretion is probably okay. I would be hesitant to support any policy change that mandated this become policy across the board, because I, as I stated on earlier calls, I think while change of registered name holder may in some cases be an indication of a potential hijacking, in the vast majority of cases it's not. So I don't necessarily think that a policy change mandating that would be appropriate.
Okay, so what you would suggest then maybe is that it's maybe best practice, or that should just be left to people's discretion?
I mean, I don't necessarily know that it should be best practice. I mean, I think James touched on an interesting point in that it isn't just the change of registered name holder. It's other factors as well that would lead a registrar to potentially believe that there's been a breach. So I don't know if it's a best practice or just something that we indicate is, you know, in cases where it may be one of a number of other factors, then the registrar should have the discretion to block a transfer, but then also should have a mechanism by which the legitimate registered name holder has a way to unlock that name if they're able to prove that the transfer is legitimate.
Okay. Now, just the problem I'm having here is just working out, let's say, for example, if we may leave something very, very kind of discretionary, how does the registrant know what's likely to happen on their account, if you follow me? In other words, how do we provide some level of predictability to the registrant?
Well, I mean, I think that's up to each individual registrar to make it clear whether, you know, in their terms of service or whether on their website or through their support folks. I mean, I guess if the choice is, you know, it's policy or we exclude it, then I vote for we exclude it. You know, if we're not comfortable having that sort of discretionary kind of language in there, then I would say it should be excluded altogether. But it's a very fair point, McKay.
Okay, thank you. Chris, Mikey, then Paul. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm just wondering, back from a practical point of view, is this whole thing is when is a change a change? Now, am I right in thinking that every one of these would have to be looked at individually by the registrar to check that it's not just changing a spelling or some of the things we talked about on the list, so to define a change being one or not? Anybody help us with that?
Chris, that's exactly the question that we're kind of asking, I think, in some respects, is defining what is it constitutes an actual change. And how do we do that? And how do you do it in such a manner that it scales?
That's right, because you could set your software so any change locked it in some way, I imagine. But if we're just talking about altering a spelling mistake, then your software would kick in. So it seems to me that every single one would have to get looked at individually by a human and then decided against a set of rules if this is a change or not a change, per se.
Yeah, I don't know. Does anybody have any thoughts on that specifically? Just want to jump in?
This is Kevin. I was just thinking that this, in my mind, is very much like a legal principle of what's called equitable ownership. That, you know, for instance, if you have a car and it has a title, that title isn't a specific, you know, person or entity, even though when you get down to the equities of the situation, like who actually paid the cash for the car, who operates it, who does this and that, there may be another person or another entity that's the equitable owner. And I think what we're sort of grappling with is we want to have some way of trying to define who that equitable owner of the domain is, and if that changes, to then, you know, base our decisions on that, not just have some correction in title or, you know, some other transaction that doesn't have any effect on who is equitably owning or controlling or whatever, however we want to define it with that particular domain. And I think that's the thing that we just have a real problem with from sort of a root level, because it does go back into a lot of the sort of existential who is discussions that we often get into in this space. So that, in my mind, it seems to me that's a useful way to think about it, is that what's our most effective way of determining who the equitable owner of a domain is, and if that changes, you know, how is that going to be expressed in things that are, you know, objectively determinable? So that's my 2 cents.
Okay. Chris, do you have anything further to add?
No, sorry, I'll get my hand down.
Okay, Mikey, Paul, and then Bob.
Thanks, Michele. It's Mikey. I think we have to sort of step back from the whole cluster of the questions for this working group sort of revolve around this topic, which is what happens right around transfer time, and are there enough sort of safeguards and processes in place to protect people from having their domains stolen? And it's too bad that Olaf isn't on the call, because he's the one who I would always turn to for sort of the history, because he was around when these questions were framed. Because the framers of these questions actually had some ideas in mind, and I don't think I wasn't in that group. I joined the group right after that. And so I'd like a little more backstory on sort of what the original framers of the question thought we should be looking at before I comment on this one. And in terms of the, I mean, I don't want to lean too heavily into the registrar gang, but I think making the decision policy versus best practices, and if it's policy, then were opposed, makes me nervous. So I'd sort of like to, you know, Marika, if you could ping Olaf and kind of get the backstory on this thing and his impressions of where the framers were headed when they posed the question, I think it would be helpful for us.
Just one thing, are these questions ones that came from the previous IRTP group?
This is Marika, if I can maybe respond.
Yeah, please.
If you look at the issues report that's up on the screen, and if you scroll to page 18, you see there some of the background discussions that I've lifted from the different, you know, previous groups to this group that indeed were in charge of developing these lists. You see several comments there that were submitted on this issue, which, you know, looking back at those documents, seem to have formed the basis for formulating this question. So that might help in, you know, trying to get the history on why this issue is now here and what the thinking around it was. As you can see, there's some, I think, comments submitted by GoDaddy, and I think there's also some comments from a staff report that, you know, noted some issues in relation to this question, and also some information from the Review of Issues for Transfers Working Group. That's, I think, a document that was developed by one of the earlier transfer working groups. So I would maybe encourage people to have a look at that, and there are links included there for those that want to even dig deeper and look further into those discussions. And I think there's even the mailing archives are still somewhere out there as well. So for someone who really wants to dig deep, and if there are any specific issues, I'm happy to look as well. All that information should be somewhere out there. And I'm also happy to check back with Olaf if he has something additional to add to what's here in the issues report.
Marika, this is Mikey. This is perfect. This is just what I was after. I don't think there's any need to bug off with this. Thanks.
Okay. Mikey, have you anything else to add? Oh, you've dropped off. Fine. Paul and then Bob.
Thanks, Michele. A couple things. So the group understands the transfers working group was the folks that came up with the questions that we had before us was a completely different set of individuals than anybody who's currently part of this or was part of IRTPA, just so you know. One thing I would underscore, though, is look at the dates. That group came up with its final report in 2006, and I think it ran at least 18 months, if not 2 years, in doing it. At the time that these issues were written down, Internet time, folks, a lot of time has passed. The market has changed dramatically in the interim. I mean, we're talking 5 years. So I wouldn't put too much emphasis on what was the thinking at the time, because we have to move with what we have as reality today. Focus on today, not try to create policy for something that's happened 5 years ago or views from 5 years ago. I also wanted to just jump back and offer total support for what Matt and James offered earlier about allowing registrars some flexibility on this question C and when they deny a transfer. Remember, there are 9 reasons under the transfer policy why a registrar may deny a request for transfer. The very first one, number one on the list, evidence of fraud. Now, that leaves a lot of latitude admitted. And it's very important that the other issues, the other points in there, are all part of a registrar's decision-making, particularly number 7, which is one of our charter questions. When the name's in lock status, is there a reasonable way for the registrar to remove the lock? Accepting that that is going to be part of the decision-making by a registrar, strongly concur with my 2 colleagues that registrars need some flexibility here in making determination. Was that change of registrant around the exact same time that the transfer request was made, is it legitimate, or is there some evidence of fraud? And exactly how they'll do it, to some degree, will be communicated in the terms of service. In other cases, honestly, that needs to be a proprietary process. It's not broadcast to the world and certainly not codified in a one-size-fits-all policy, because the bad guys will simply find a way around it. And the only other question, a lot of people offered a lot of stuff. I forgot my 3rd point, so I'll just jump off.
Do you want to come back to that one, and it comes back to you, Paul, if you remember what it was?
No problem. Thank you.
Okay. Bob?
Yes. Thanks, Michele. I guess, you know, just to that point, our fast transfer network, which is high-value premium domains, has about 50 resellers, most of which are registrars. We've chosen to have a fairly strict interpretation of that, where any change in any field in the WHOIS record would result in a transfer lock. That said, we are looking at perhaps changing that so that certain fields in the WHOIS record would trigger the transfer lock. Other fields would not, and we're just going through that process to determine which fields we feel are necessary and would trigger, and which ones would not be a trigger. So that's a process we're going through right now. But I would, you know, just tend to be very supportive of the previous commenters in that, you know, registrar flexibility, I think, is a good thing and essential on that. So thank you.
Okay. Anybody else have any other thoughts on this? Okay. No further thoughts on that for the moment. Right. I think there's some good discussion on this on the mailing list. So I think it would be helpful if people were just even trying to you know, put some of that into an email to the list, see what other people are saying. So I know there's about 50% of the people who are on this working group are on the call today. So it would be helpful if we got some more input and some exchange some views. Now, with regard to the fourth item on our agenda today, Charter Issue D, which is in relation to registrar lock statuses, when it may or may not, should or should not be applied, whether we need to have standards and best practices regarding use of lock statuses. Does anybody have any thoughts or feelings or opinions on this topic? Bob, is that from before?
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'll take it back.
That's okay. Now that you still got it up, I'm just going to pick on you. Do you have any thoughts on lock statuses, Bob?
You know, again, that's one where I would tend to support, you know, some flexibility. I think the, you know, that most of our registrars' partners work, you know, work differently in this, you know, in this respect. Some are, you know, the lock periods are different. We just generally tend to find that it works well giving the registrars, you know, some measure of flexibility. So I'd be, you know, reluctant to get a lot more structure in that respect without, you know, without a lot more input from the registrar community, to be honest.
Okay. Mikey, then Chris.
Thanks, Michele. It's Mikey. I'm remembering back to the Brussels meeting when Rob Hall sort of did a thing that I like a lot and sort of said, you know, maybe we ought to sort of step back from locks and think about the world of EPP and sort of rethink the whole question. And I was curious what other people's reactions was to that. It's, you know, I'm not a deep expert on all that stuff, and I wasn't sure whether he was saying something that was useful and helpful, because, you know, I know that sometimes old technologies sort of get embedded, and it's useful to every once in a while sort of step back and say, the technology that's widely accepted has now changed, and yet we're sort of using old mechanisms, old techniques that perhaps are more cumbersome, and this might be an opportunity to upgrade that process. But like I say, I'm not deep into registrar operations. I don't know if that's a useful thing or not.
Okay, I've got a queue of people backing up here. Some of them may have some comments to help with Mikey. Chris, Matt, and then Paul. Does anybody have anything to address Mikey's queries?
Yeah, I do.
Go ahead.
It's Matt. Yeah. So, Mikey, when Rob made that statement, I initially came out of my seat, frankly, and then actually I talked to him about it in the hallway later. And Mikey, what you hit on is actually a very good point. I think as a working group, we need to make a decision, right? And I think we can decide to make recommendations and comments and suggest policy sort of in our current existing EPP world, or, and this is kind of where Rob was going, and when I talked to him afterward, it actually made a lot more sense to me, or we could look at, you know, kind of throwing out what we currently have and saying, you know, yeah, that worked 5, 7, 8 years ago, but now there's some much more secure technologies and some much more, you know, robust things that we can suggest, and I think as a working group, we need to sort of make those decisions, because there's a lot of stuff that we could do, things like, you know, token IDs and two-factor authentication, not only with transfers, but with change of registrant, and a whole bunch of different stuff that, should we choose to, you know, really could have a drastic effect on the way that the domain name system works today. So, you know, I don't know the best way to do that, but I think it's probably something that's worth discussing as a group.
Okay.
Can I jump in, Michele? Respond to that?
Yeah, please go ahead.
It's Paul. Hey, Matt. Yeah, you know, I one of our senior engineers was in Brussels as well, and as soon as Rob said that, I asked him what his thought was, and he had just an immediate reaction. He's like, getting rid of all locks and going to EPP only just creates an enormous security liability because you have a single point of failure now. The bad guys will focus all their attention on figuring out ways to get around one single standard. I mean, look at the marketplace that we have now. We have a diversity of security protocols that registrars can put in place, some that come with the service, some that are value-add, depending on the needs and demands of the registrants. I'm not in favor of getting rid of locks and moving, just putting all of our faith in EPP. Yes, there's some gee whiz stuff that goes around that might be used, but let's also consider the whole marketplace. Some registrars are capable of doing that. Many are not. Many barely get by. What about the entire reseller part of the marketplace as well? Will they have the technical abilities to do some of the cutting-edge things that Rob was thinking about? I think right now there's a reason locks are in place and have become a de facto standard in the industry, because they're simple, they're easy to get your head around. Whether a legitimate registrant has the ability to take that lock down in order to process a transfer request, or if the registrar is blocking them in some way, that's a valid question, but that's a compliance issue. I don't think it should really enter into our policy discussions about getting rid of locks.
Yeah, Michele, sorry, is it okay if I just respond?
No, go on.
You guys are talking,
but this is good.
Paul, let me be clear. Like I said, I had the exact same reaction that your engineer initially had, and I'm not at all saying that I think, we can do away with locks and, put this one thing in place and we're all set, but I think that the larger question of, as a working group, do we want to look at, our existing protocols and systems and look at these questions in that light, or do we, to Mikey's point, want to look at, more of a broader-based kind of, newer technologies and other things? We may look at it and decide, yeah, what we have is, everyone knows it, and like you said, resellers and registrars and registrants are used to it and things like that. I don't know, frankly. And after talking to Rob a little more, it did get me thinking, are we, for lack of a better term, do we just have tunnel vision, and because, we're so used to the systems in which we operate today, is that, how we're looking at these questions? And if someone came in from the outside and wasn't as intimately familiar with, the back end piece of all this, would they, look at things differently and maybe put us in different directions and things like that? I don't know, but it might be something that we, maybe it's not germane to this working group, but, maybe it's part of what we, recommend for, future working groups. I don't know.
Okay, Chris, and then James.
Yeah, I think we're almost onto something here, and I think we do have some sort of duty to explore it. I'm sure we won't get to the end to finish it, but at least if at some point we acknowledge that there is a suggestion to do this, and then we could go with a small table or something of pros and cons, reasons it would be a good idea and other reasons it wouldn't be a good idea, and there we've got it, and then somebody later could build on it. Back to the original reason I put my hand up about the locks. As a business and as a registrant, I suppose, I don't like the locks because I don't fully understand them. I know we've talked about it earlier and looked at the lists, but it's as simple as that, I think. And I'm supposed to know more than most businesses on it. So I think some sort of structure or understanding, I think, is a great advantage. Thank you.
James, and then Mikey.
Hi, Michele, James here, and I think that I support what Paul was saying earlier for the most part, is that be a little concerned about going in and removing all locks and just kind of letting that shake out, with the understanding that a lot of smaller registrars or resellers may not have the wherewithal or the sophistication to actually exist and impose security in an environment like that. I think that the locks are interesting because they allow degrees of control, degrees of protection. You know, one of the responses I had to Rob in Brussels was, you know, in the case where a name is under review for UDRP, where you want to provide use of the name in case the UDRP fails, but you don't want it to transfer away or be deleted in case the UDRP is successful. And so it exists somewhat in this gray area where the registered name holder has full access and use of the name but can't dispose of it. And I think that locks are helpful in that regard because they allow us to establish these different varying levels of control. But I think that, you know, there, it is a good point, and I think the general point that Rob was making is why don't we step back from some of the nuances of these issues and look at the general question of whether or not they're still serving their original purpose. And I think that's a valid point and something that we should consider for all of these questions.
Okay. Mikey?
I want to amplify James's last sentence. You know, I think that the headline, quote, remove all locks, unquote, is probably something that Rob wouldn't sign up for as a summary of what he said. I mean, he was using it to sort of wake us up from a meeting that came right after a heavy night of drinking and we were all pretty tired. I think he was using that phrase for shock value. But I think that he would agree with a lot of the things that everybody's saying. No, we don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater. No, we don't want to put less sophisticated registrants, registrars, resellers in an impossible situation. But at the same time, the tech has changed. And it's important to provide a mechanism to upgrade the process with the newer kinds of technology, especially if those technologies are more secure. I'm sure that he wouldn't lobby for turning off locks without providing a path for people to migrate to whatever's new, and I'm also pretty sure that he wouldn't want us to design the new system. But at the same time, I think that we can do some damage if we don't at least acknowledge the fact that the tech is improving and changing and that there are possibilities to use that to improve life for everybody.
Paul, somebody else had a hand up but seems to have disappeared.
Yeah,
it was Matt.
Yeah, I put it down.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Michele. I'm sensitive to the time, so I'll be quick. For those who may not be able to see the chat in Adobe, I just wanted to read my point into the record. It's a question of procedure. This working group has very specific charter questions, and I don't know how expansive a definition or how far we want to carry the our mandate in terms of this issue D, but I don't necessarily see this group empowered to start looking into all the current technology or security-related technologies that could be brought to bear here. Our charter question asks about practices regarding the implementation and the use of register lock status. So it's a point of a question of procedure. Does our mandate include a review and potential recommendations of new technologies, or do we have a narrow view and therefore just have to put a recommendation in our final report that a future working group specifically have the mandate in their charter to look at these things in more detail?
Okay. Does anybody have any thoughts on that?
Well, I'll just repeat what I put in the chat, which is that I support, you know, recommendation that future working groups would look at stuff like that. And you know, I guess I will make the comment that I had my hand up for, and it'll be quick, and I don't want to, you know, belabor the point. But, you know, with all due respect to James and Paul, I heard everyone talk about, you know, all these less sophisticated registrars and a network of resellers. And to me, I think we just need to be careful about, shooting for the least
the lowest common denominator, essentially. And if we feel that something is a best practice or a new policy or, you know, whatever it may be, and it creates, you know, some difficulties for registrars that need to relearn something or get more sophisticated, I think that's okay. I think at the end of the day, if it's for the betterment of the registrants and the larger internet community, then I think that's fine. And again, I'm not saying that Paul and James were saying that we should do that, but you know, that was just one thing that jumped out at me, is that, you know, we shouldn't be racing to the bottom with that stuff. I'm done.
James?
Yeah, I just wanted to respond to that, Matt, because I think I may have misunderstood you, and I think you came away with the opposite of what I was trying to say, which was that we shouldn't leave this wide open, that the policy should have some minimum protections for registered name holders and registrants, because, you know, if we just rely on what the registrars can do, some of them will, as you mentioned, race to the bottom and will have very little protection. So, you know, I just wanted to clear that up. It sounded like you know, I wasn't being very articulate earlier and left a lot of ambiguity in that statement.
No, okay, cool. Thanks, James.
Okay, it's Rich coming up to the top of the hour. Mikey, you have a hand up?
Yeah, just one last. This is Mikey. Just one last thing. I understand Paul's point about a narrow charter. On the other hand, sometimes we can dodge an issue by being very careful not to step outside of a narrow charter. And I think that this is one of those cases where our community might get a little bit frustrated with us. I think that's where Rob was really coming from. It was sort of saying, lads, look about. There's other stuff going on. Don't be so cautious in the interpretation of your charter that you ignore the fact that the world has changed a lot. You know, I'm fine with the notion of acknowledging it and punting it down the road to another working group, although if the current pace of IRTP working groups continues, that means that the working group probably won't take it up until after the world has ended in 2012. And, you know, in the meantime, a lot of opportunities are going to be missed. So just a little pushback on the sort of narrow interpretation of the charter approach. I'm not sure that that's really what the community was asking us to do.
Okay. Does anybody else want to dive in here? No? Okay, then. Right, then. Thanks, everybody, for your input. If people have any specific thoughts on charters issues C or D or any other points, could you please post them to the list? If you are members of any stakeholder group that has not submitted a comment, could you please remind your various stakeholder groups to please submit comments, regardless of any deadlines? I know we've had problems in the past with getting comments from all of the stakeholder groups, so I don't feel particularly guilty about giving people a gentle, even though slightly blunt, nudge. Any other queries, questions, or matters at this time? Anybody?
Michele, we do have a call next week, and then we're taking 2 weeks off in August. Is that correct?
Yes. That was the general idea. As Marika is away, as staff support, and I think other people mentioned that they were taking holidays as well, and I don't know, I don't think it's such a bad idea in the grand scheme of things. So we would have a meeting at the normal time next week. If there are no other matters...
Okay.
If there are no other matters, then I'll adjourn the call and speak to you all next week.
Thanks, Michele.
Thank you, Michele.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See you, Michele.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.